This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
We last met in an hour of shock and suffering. In 4 short months, our nation has comforted the victims, begun to rebuild New York and the Pentagon, rallied a great coalition, captured, arrested, and rid the world of thousands of terrorists, destroyed Afghanistan's terrorist training camps, saved the people from starvation, and freed a country from brutal oppression. The American flag flies again over our embassy in Kabul. Terrorists who once occupied Afghanistan now occupy cells at Guantanamo Bay.
President George W. Bush delivering the State of the Union address on January 29, 2002. It has been 20 years since the first prisoners arrived at the U.S. detention facility at Guantanamo Bay. On November 13, 2001, President Bush signed a military order that established tribunals at Guantanamo. Placing the prison outside of the United States allowed the Bush administration to hold prisoners indefinitely, deny them the right to a writ of habeas corpus, meaning the prisoners could not challenge whether the U.S. government was holding them legally. The administration also classified the prisoners as terrorists instead of prisoners of war, and therefore cast them into a legal dead zone outside the Geneva Conventions. The Bush administration also authored memos justifying the use of torture. Though it was later proven that many detainees were innocent of any crimes against the United States, President Bush never fully stepped away from his assertion that the prisoners were a threat.
Remember, these are the ones in Guantanamo Bay are killers. They don't share the same values we share. They would like nothing more than to come after America.
However, by September 2006, and after years of legal and human rights controversies, Bush said he aspired to close it down.
I don't want to make any predictions about whether Guantanamo will be available or not. I'm just telling you it's a very complicated subject. And I laid out an aspiration. Whether or not we can achieve that or not, we'll try to. But it's not as easy a subject as some may think.
Indeed. 20 years later, Guantanamo Bay is still open, and it has haunted and bedeviled every president for the past 2 decades.
This first executive order that we are signing by the authority vested in me as president by the Constitution and the laws of the United States of America, in order to effect the appropriate disposition of individuals currently detained by the Department of Defense at Guantanamo, and promptly to close the detention facility at Guantanamo consistent with the national security and foreign policy interests of the United States and the interests of justice, I hereby order.
President Barack Obama, January 22, 2009, in his first act as Commander-in-Chief, signing Executive Order 13492 to close Guantanamo Bay. The Obama administration was unable to keep that promise. 7 years later, February 2016, Obama presented yet another plan to Congress to finally close the prison.
As president, I've spent countless hours dealing with this. I do not exaggerate about that. Our closest allies raise it with me continually. They often raise specific cases of detainees repeatedly. I don't want to pass this problem on to the next president, whoever it is. And if, as a nation, we don't deal with this now, when will we deal with it? Are we going to let this linger on for another 15 years, another 20 years, another 30 years?
Obama left office. The detention facility at Guantanamo Bay remained open. On the campaign trail, President Donald Trump promised to keep Gitmo open, and he did. Here he is in his 2018 State of the Union address.
So today I'm keeping another promise. I just signed, prior to walking in, an order directing Secretary Mattis, who is doing a great job. Thank you. To reexamine our military detention policy and to keep open the detention facilities in Guantanamo Bay.
However, if not the moral cost, It was the prison's economic cost that troubled the Trump administration. By 2019, Trump said it was, quote, crazy that the U.S. spends $13 million a year on each detainee held at Guantanamo. I think it's crazy, Trump said. It costs a fortune to operate. I think it's crazy. And yet, Guantanamo remained open. As it does today, under President Joe Biden. At a Democratic debate in 2020, then-candidate Biden was asked why President Obama and he, as vice president, hadn't closed the prison.
Why couldn't you close Guantanamo Bay? Why couldn't the Obama administration close Guantanamo Bay?
We attempted to close Guantanamo Bay, but you have to have congressional authority to do it. They've kept it open. And the fact is that we, in fact, think it's the greatest. It is an advertisement for creating terror.
However, now, under the Biden administration, it's not clear whether closing Guantanamo Bay is a high priority for the president. So, four presidents, 20 years. Today, we're going to talk about the moral, political, and legal legacy of the detention center at Guantanamo Bay that is still there, still holding about 40 prisoners, still costing money, still a stain on the U.S.'s reputation. And we'll begin with Marine Corps Brigadier General Michael Leonard. He was the man ordered to build the detention center in January of 2002. He retired in 2009 with the rank of Major General, and he joins us from Traverse City, Michigan. Major General Leonard, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Magna. It's good to be here.
Can you first tell us when you received the orders to build the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay? Tell us that story.
Absolutely. It was the afternoon of Friday, January 4th, that we received a deployment order at my Marine Corps command, 2nd Force Service Support Group at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. We were expecting that some type of order like that might come. Secretary Rumsfeld tended to sign most deployment orders on a Friday. That order directed me to form a joint task force of soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, and Coast Guardsmen, deploy to the naval base in Guantanamo, Cuba, build 100 cells capable of holding the detainees, and be prepared to receive them in 96 hours of receipt of the deployment order. We completed the cells in 87 hours. I probably got the job because I'd commanded the Cuban and Haitian migrant camps earlier in Guantanamo in 1995. And additionally, the unit that I commanded was one of the few that could respond in the timeline required by the administration. Mm. The Army actually has the responsibility for running prisoner of war camps, but I was told that they were not going to be able to get there in the time frame the administration wanted. I was told to plan on coming home in 60 days. In fact, we were at Guantanamo for 98 when I turned over command to an Army joint task force.
96 hours. Well, the first prisoners arrived soon after the prison was constructed. Can you tell us about them?
Yeah, I sure can. The first detainees arrived on January the 11th, and there were 20 of them. They arrived in a C-17 after flying nonstop from Afghanistan and doing mid-air refueling. I am told that the flight normally takes about 22 hours. As you said earlier, they'd been described by the Pentagon as the worst of the worst. Carol Rosenberg, who you're going to hear from later, was witness to that first detainee transfer. So the detainees were taken from the plane. They were dressed in heavy padded jumpsuits. They'd been manacled. They wore goggles and headsets. Most who arrived were dehydrated, disoriented, and scared. They hadn't been told where they were. They left winter in Afghanistan, and they found themselves in a tropical climate. We loaded the first detainees into two school buses. The windows were blacked out, and they, with the guards who had met the plane, left the airfield, which is on the other side of Guantanamo Bay. So the buses had to be ferried across to the mainland and to the detention facility at X-Ray. X-Ray was the site selected because it had concrete hardstand, water, and electrical drops. But by any standard, it was the wrong place to put them. But the time frame of the deployment order left us no other option.
You're retired now, General. So can you tell me honestly, what did you think in those first days as the first prisoners arrived in the manner that they did, as you described?
Well, you know, of course, I had been told, as had everybody else, that these were the worst of the worst. When they arrived, though, I was actually already thinking about how we had to conduct ourselves. And I wasn't getting a lot of guidance from the Pentagon or the administration. I resolved that we would follow the Geneva Conventions. I was told at the time that I would be guided by them. I decided to follow them. And there were a couple of things that we couldn't do because it was not practical to do so. I mean, you don't pay the detainees as the Geneva Conventions require, and a couple of other issues that are in the Geneva Conventions. But I stipulated that in every case, if we did not follow them, it had to be my decision and not somebody beneath me.
Mm. I want to come back in a few minutes and talk to you more about that because, of course, as we know, in the months and years following the opening of Guantanamo Bay, of the detention facility, there was, you know, the revelations of torture that went on there. You left, though, after, what, a little more than 3 months, you handed over command of the detention facility, right?
Yeah, that's okay. Correct. And the mission I received, Meghna, was detention, not mm-hmm. interrogation. Mm-hmm. Now, about halfway through my deployment, another unit was sent down with the responsibility for interrogation. And of course, that set up what we would refer to in the military as a Clausewitzian friction. My job was to detain them and treat them humanely. The job of the other force, of course, was to get information. As you will recall, there was a great deal of belief that these individuals represented an intelligence goldmine.
General, we're going to talk a lot more after a quick break, but I want to ask you one quick thing. If you had to describe how you feel in one word about the fact that Guantanamo Bay is still there today, what would that word be?
Regret.
We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Last month marked the 20th anniversary of the arrivals of the first prisoners at the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay. So today we're talking with people who have direct experience with that, who worked there, who were imprisoned there, and who have been reporting on the long-term legal, moral and economic legacy of the prison at Guantanamo Bay. I'm joined today by retired Major General Michael Leonard. He supervised the construction of the detention camp at Gitmo in January 2002. He ran the facility for 3 months. And General Leonard, we're going to hear a little bit more from you in a moment, but I just want to now turn to someone who was imprisoned at Guantanamo. Muazzam Beg joins us from Birmingham, England. He spent 2 years as a detainee there from 2003 to 2005. Today, he's outreach director at the nonprofit group CAGE, which advocates for the rule of law. He's co-author of Enemy Combatant, My Imprisonment at Guantanamo, Bagram, and Kandahar. Muazzam, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Meghna, and thanks for having me.
I actually want to start with the question that I ended the previous segment with General Leonard. What is the one word you would use to know when you think about the fact that Guantanamo is still there today?
Disbelief.
And your disbelief is informed by your personal experience there. So can you tell us about how you were first taken and why you were first taken to Guantanamo in 2003?
I had been held in the Bagram detention facility. Prior to that, I'd been captured or taken from my home in Pakistan in 2002 at the beginning. In front of my wife and children, I was abducted at gunpoint and taken hooded and shackled without any access to any legal recourse, without any uniformed or identified police officers taking me. And I was handed over shortly after that by Pakistani authorities to the U.S. military and then taken to Kandahar, where I was processed like all the other prisoners. We were stripped naked, beaten, spat upon, our photographs taken in this way, and then taken into shivering naked into tents where I was interrogated by members of the FBI, by military intelligence, by CIA, and then held, as I said, in Kandahar for about 6 weeks, and then in Bagram for about 11 months before being sent to Guantanamo. In Bagram, I saw two prisoners beaten to death by US soldiers, including one who had his hands tied to the top of a cage and was repeatedly beaten and punched. I was subjected to the sounds of a woman screaming in one of the cells that I was led to believe was my wife being tortured while they waved pictures of my children in front of me. So by the end of being held in Bagram in a situation atmosphere like that, I was actually looking forward to going to Guantanamo. And I don't say that with any great relish, because I understood that Guantanamo was a place where the law did not apply and that had been chosen precisely because the law didn't apply there. And whatever movement was going to happen for me from Bagram, even if it meant Guantanamo, was going to be better. And so I woke up in Guantanamo in a 8-foot by 6-foot cell after being drugged, because the journey was so painful, with my eyes, my ears, my face covered and shackled to a chair for almost 30 odd hours. I begged for a sedative. And so when I arrived in Guantanamo, I was in a daze. And what I remember is just literally being washed down with a hose and a sponge with a stick at the end of it, and then being taken off into this cell, which became my home for the next 2 years.
Now, I suppose some listeners might be wondering why you were even taken into custody in Pakistan. If I understand correctly, Muazzam, you had been in Afghanistan with your wife in 2000 building a school. So you actually had been in Afghanistan, but in 2002, when you were arrested, you were back in Pakistan.
Correct, yes. So I'd gone in 2001 with my wife and my kids. We were continuing a project that I'd begun from the UK to build a school in Kabul for girls. And it must be said, this was at the time of the Taliban. So it's something that I wanted to be part of. And I remained there until the US invasion and evacuated under those bombs and made it to Pakistan, took up residence there. And it was from there that I was kidnapped. The answer as to why me, there are two reasons. One is that the United States offered bounty money. They dropped, like, as Donald Rumsfeld said, like snowflakes in December in Chicago, offering bounties of up to $5,000 for each foreign person. Which is what happened in a large number of cases. And the other part was false and flawed intelligence offered by British intelligence to the Americans to say that I was connected to Al-Qaeda, which I was not. But of course, that all became clear in Guantanamo after I was released.
Mm. Now, to be clear, there have been and are, even to this day, some detainees at Guantanamo who do have and did have known ties to terrorist groups. But they were not, obviously not all of the detainees. But I don't want to put forth the notion that 100% of the people who were sent to Guantanamo had no ties to terrorism. I mean, Muazzam, you are one of those people who were innocent. So can you tell us more about how you were treated during your 2 years of imprisonment there?
Well, the majority of my time was spent in Camp Echo, which was maximum security solitary confinement. And it varied from place to place and time to time over years. So in the beginning, I was allowed out just for half an hour, three times a week, completely. Otherwise, the rest of the time, 23 hours and a half, or 24 hours, was spent entirely inside this cell. I was dealt with as somebody that's regarded as high value. So when I was taken out of my cell on the rare occasion into what's known as the recreation yard, which is about 15 foot by 15 foot covered with chain link fence, there had to be an entire process of guards with guns, infantry patrols, the military working dog, as they called it, all being called just because I was being taken out into this kind of recreation area. Shortly after this, people started to realize, I think even those in charge, that this is a ridiculous process. But it is, much of this was happening under the watch of General Jeffrey Miller. And for those who don't know, General Miller, he helped to implement the enhanced interrogation programs mm-hmm. here, but then went on to what's known as to Guantanamoize the detention process in Abu Ghraib. And of course, those types of abuses now have become world renowned. But for me, having spent the majority of my time in solitary confinement, I didn't get to mix with many of the other prisoners up until the last few months when I was put on in Papa Block with people like, for example, Osama bin Laden's driver, Osama bin Laden's cook, Osama bin Laden's media man, and a couple of others, who all ended up, except for one, going home despite their connection to bin Laden. And so to answer the question about who was innocent and who was guilty, really, in any free society, it would be a law, a court of law that is transparent that determines that. And after all, the United States has one of those systems built upon the system that was taken from the United Kingdom. If you look at Magna Carta and habeas corpus and all these things that have been mentioned. So it wasn't for lack of having a system. It was that the system was corrupt right from the beginning and remains that way with the military commissions process after 20 years. Not a single person has been convicted for the reason why Guantanamo was to set up, and that was to catch those involved in perpetrating 9/11.
Moazzam, hang on here for just a second, because I'd like to turn back to General Lennart. You heard Moazzam talk about the enhanced interrogation techniques as they were referred to in the Bush administration. I mean, subsequently, many people in the United States and internationally would just call it torture. You had mentioned earlier, General, that you decided to stay within the rules of the Geneva Conventions. Does that mean that you were receiving pressure, even in those first early months of Guantanamo being open, were you receiving pressure from the Bush administration to engage in those enhanced interrogation techniques?
I was receiving some pressure. At that time, Magna, they had not yet developed the concept, I think, fully, or at least presented it to those who would be expected to execute it. I think the administration decided, since I was going home, just to wait me out, and that's what happened.
What are you thinking? What's going through your mind, General, as you heard Moazzam tell? This is just like the surface of his story of his experience in at Guantanamo.
I think about the lost opportunity that America had. After 9/11, we had both the sympathy and the cooperation of most of the international community, and we squandered it. You know, Moazzam mentioned the bounties that were being paid for so-called bad guys. I can't think of a worse way to figure out who actually is against us. And what we did was we actually gave, in my view, aid and comfort to the enemy by our own actions. You know, if the objective of terrorism is to change who we are as a nation, by any objective standard, they succeeded.
I actually don't know if the two of you, have you spoken together before?
I believe there was one point where, Moazzam, you correct me if I am wrong, but I was giving a lecture at the University of in Puerto Rico, and I believe you came on at that time. Is that accurate, or was it some other gentleman? It's been a while.
I think that's right. And if I may, Meghna, I just want to say that last night I was sitting with somebody that Mike knows very well, and that person's name is Shakir Amer, detainee 239. And he told me a story that really I found extremely moving and one that I didn't know before. And that is that during the time that he was there with the early prisoners, Major General Mike Lennart was, of course, in charge. He came and spoke to the prisoners and treated them with a great deal of decency. So the first thing Shakir said, and Mansour Addaifi and some other prisoners I spoke to when I told them I'll be speaking with you today, was to say that please send him our warmest regards, because we will never forget the way in which he treated us with great dignity and humanity. And Shakir related to me this story that Major General Mike came and announced to him or explained to him after he'd distributed sweets to all the other prisoners. Shakir had asked prior to this, I'd like to know what has happened to my wife and children. Are they alive? Are they dead? Are they in prison? What's happening to them? And so he actually made a call to his family and brought back the news to Shakir that you have had a son born whilst you're in custody. And on the occasion of this birth, he distributed sweets to all the prisoners before going to Shakir, sitting on the floor in the dust, taking off his hat and handing these sweets over and giving this this news to him. This act Shakir has never forgotten. Many of the prisoners have never forgotten. And this act is one of the reasons, there are many others, that all the prisoners there do not hate the United States of America. And so I just wanted to convey that. And it's something that when I heard, I was moved almost to tears.
You know, Muazzam and General Lennart, I have to say, for me as an American citizen, having both of you together on this show is quite, it feels surreal, remarkable. You know, the man who, under orders, built this facility, and a man who was imprisoned in it. And at the same time, I also am just imbued with this sense that we as a nation here in the United States are definitely wanting to forget what has been going on there for 20 continuous years now. And so I just want to hear from both of you. And Muazzam, I'll start with you. But what does it cost? What does it continue to cost the United States as the nation, you know, turns its back on Guantanamo but keeps it open?
You know, one of the first things I did when I came back from Guantanamo is I made an appeal to some hostage takers in Iraq who had dressed captives, Americans and Britons, in orange jumpsuits and threatened to execute them. They did it. Using that kind of imagery of Guantanamo and the orange jumpsuits. The greatest irony I've seen at the moment is, again, I tried to make appeals to those ISIS hostage takers who captures British and American, again, journalists and aid workers and dressed them in orange jumpsuits, waterboarded them. Crucially, that's an important thing. Mm. And then executed them. Ironically, they're now facing charges for war crimes and crimes in the United States where they've been extradited to, including waterboarding their captives. There are prisoners in Guantanamo still, like Abu Zubaydah and Abdurrahim and Nashiri, who were waterboarded a multitude of times. We've made films in Hollywood about them. There's award-winning films made by leading actors and actresses that portray what took place in the report, the torture report. And yet still, unbelievably, for these crimes, nobody's been held to account. The United States has admitted that these crimes took place. Guantanamo remains open, and it remains as one of the things I would say is that it is a bipartisan project. Guantanamo has been overseen by Democrat and by a Republican. It's been overseen by a black president and white presidents. It's been overseen by East Coasters and West Coasters. And it is wholly American as far as the rest of the world thinks. We, as the prisoners there, none of us, including me, the majority had never been to America. And the only thing we've ever seen of America was that display, whether it was in Bagram, Guantanamo, or elsewhere, of these American soldiers acting out what they'd been told against us, that we are the worst of the worst. But what we saw was amongst the worst of the worst. And for that to be changed is going to require a generation.
General Lennart, we have a minute before the break, and I'd want to hear from you. What is it costing the U.S.?
I'll keep it short. It's cost us our moral authority as world leaders. Not just Guantanamo, but torture anywhere. Torture is wrong. You can't dress it up. with words like enhanced interrogation techniques. And the information that we received from those interviews, as they like to say, was questionable at best. There's a possibility we received some information, but frankly, it was how do you pick out the actionable intelligence that you receive from everything else that somebody will tell you just because they want the pain to stop?
Well, retired Major General Michael Lennert joining us today from Traverse City, Michigan. General Lennert, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Magna. And thank you, Muazzam.
And Muazzam Beg spent 2 years at Guantanamo Bay as a detainee there from 2003 to 2005. Today, he's outreach director for a nonprofit called CAGE, which advocates for the rule of law. With us from Birmingham, England, Muazzam, thank you.
Thank you, Meghna, and thank you very much, Mike.
We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
There was another guy in front of me. He was hanging in front of me. The first day they hang me on chain, I could see him, that he is moving and people going to him to talk to him or to try to talk to him. And he couldn't survive. He died. After he died, they let him just hang over there.
The thing I learned with the Americans is that you could destroy somebody's life, destroy him completely without even touching him. However strong, however tough you are, however principled you are, however much you don't want to cause any problems, but it will destroy you. It's not something you'll see. As I said, in third world country, they're so stupid. They beat you, and look, you can all, look, they've tortured me, they do this. I came out of Guantanamo, and physically, I could not show anything. But I have to tell you, the pain I carry inside and the memories I have are really very great. And I have nothing to show.
Dans le bloc où j'étais, moi c'était le bloc B à X-ray.
In the block where I was, which was block B at X-ray, there was a man named Jumaha, whom I got to know a little. He was often being insulted, so what did he do? Well, he insulted the guard back, and they got inside his cage, they beat him up, and on top of it all, they grabbed Jumaha's head and bashed it on the floor. And later, there were bloodstains. The guard, the top guard, who was taping the scene, he asked for it to be especially violent because he wanted to make it an example of why one must not talk back.
Zine desa hayatımdaki en güzel vaktim türmede begunah ayalıkka ehmiyetsiz ötti.
The golden years of my life, young man's life between 27 till 35, passed in the incarceration and the being in the jail without committing any crime. And for an innocent man to spend such golden years of his life in a jail, it's gone. It never come back.
Those are the voices of Murat Kurnaz, a German citizen, Bishr al-Rawi of Iraq, Brahim Yadel of France, and Abdul Ghaffar Abdul Rahman of East Turkestan, describing their time as prisoners at Guantanamo Bay. The interviews were conducted by the San Francisco-based organization Witness to Guantanamo. They have many other interviews with former detainees, guards, family members, and lawyers. We have a link to that organization at onpointradio.org. Well, joining me now is Carol Rosenberg. She covers Guantanamo Bay for the New York Times, and before that, for the Miami Herald. She has been reporting on the detention facility there ever since the camp was opened 20 years ago in January. And over that 20 years, she's stayed at Guantanamo Bay for more than 1,500 nights. Carol is also author of Guantanamo Bay, The Pentagon's Alcatraz of the Caribbean. Welcome to On Point, Carol.
Thank you, Magna. Nice to be here.
You know, I had asked both the general and Muazzam the one word that comes to mind when thinking of the fact that Guantanamo Bay is still open. And I'd like to ask the same of you. What is that one word for you?
I'm sorry to say the answer is unsurprised. What has gone on in the last 20 years across these four administrations has not made it possible to close it. First of all, go ahead.
No, please. You were heading in the direction I wanted to go. Go ahead.
First of all, it was conceived as essentially a prisoner of war camp in a forever war for which there's no one on the other side to surrender, for which there's no actual POWs on the other side to exchange. And so when you take prisoners and you move them halfway around the world and you put them in cages, and then ultimately in these prisons that look like copies of American prisons, in a war that you've declared is in perpetuity, it's very difficult to figure out how to exit that war. I mean, we've left Afghanistan, and we still have prisoners at Guantanamo who were brought there from Afghanistan.
Mm. And, you know, we've barely touched on the legal element here. I just made quick mention of it at the top. There are still trials or judicial proceedings going on in Guantanamo right now with some of the 39 remaining detainees. Can you tell us a little bit about what's happening there at the moment, Carol?
And six of those men on trial are on trial for their lives. These are death penalty proceedings at a military commission, which is a court that was created by Congress after 9/11 to try people at Guantanamo Bay, people in particular who were brought to the military prison from years in the black sites of the CIA. There's five men who are accused of plotting the 9/11 attacks, mm-hmm. best known as Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. I think people may remember the capture photo of him rousted from his bed in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. There's another man there who's in a capital case named Abdulrahim al-Nashri, who's a Saudi, who's accused of plotting the USS Cole attack. You know, the United States has done a series of drone hits through the years of people they said were plotters of the USS Cole or masterminds of the USS Cole attacks. And he's the one they captured, and he has a trial ongoing. These trials have been going since, I shouldn't say trials, because they aren't before the juries. They're still at the level of pretrial litigation in front of a military judge since 2011 and 2012. You make up a new court, you bring in people from 4 and 3 years in the black sites where they were denied lawyers, access to the Red Cross, subjected to torture by all measures. And then you try to put them on trial. You spend years in pretrial proceedings figuring out what, if any, evidence is usable at that trial and what the consequences can be. Because it's a death penalty trial, they've got some of the best American paid U.S. criminal defense lawyers, and they are fighting for every scrap of evidence in order to argue, if they are convicted, that the United States does not have the moral authority to execute them. And so it's gone on for a decade.
Huh. I mean, the irony there is biting, especially in the case of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, as you pointed out. I mean, ostensibly, he's on trial for his role in 9/11. But it sounds like what you're saying is that the U.S., it's essentially itself is on trial for all of the, you know, the torture and the black sites as is being revealed in these pretrial hearings.
So, you know, I meet the 9/11 families who are brought down. There's a small pool of relatives of people who were killed on that day who signed up to travel to Guantanamo and watch these pretrial proceedings. And it's extremely painful for them. Mm-hmm. You know, this man, after he was taken into CIA custody and waterboarded. And, you know, these enhanced interrogation techniques, as they are called, basically, you know, break down a human being to, some would argue, say whatever their captors want them to hear. So after he was captured, he actually boasted that he plotted 9/11 from A to Z, evidence that probably can't be admitted at the trial. And so it is painful to them that this man is still in pretrial proceedings. And what I say to them, and it's not reassuring, it's not comforting, is that the pretrial is the defendant's trial. It's the place where they try to get the evidence and create the best conditions for the victim's trial, which is when a jury is brought in and we learn about what happened on 9/11 and what these men did or didn't do to further that attack by 19 hijackers that killed 2,976 people in four crashed airplanes on September 11th, 2001. And I have to say this because some of your listeners, 9/11 is a distant memory, mm-hmm. but not for the family members. And so what's going on is, in a sense, yes, the CIA is on trial now while the defense lawyers try to get the whole weeks go by down there. We've had dozens of weeks of pretrial sessions. Whole weeks go by down there with the conversations about the CIA and nothing about what happened on 9/11 at the 9/11 proceedings.
Wow. You know, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is also actually the perfect example of the conundrum the U.S. finds itself in, even if, you know, amongst those politicians who want to close the detention facility there, right? Because, I mean, over the past 20 years, repeatedly, one of the problems is what to do with the remaining detainees, or even for the ones who were determined to be innocent of any wrongdoing, where would they go? I mean, that problem hasn't been solved yet, Carol, has it?
It has not. So the woulda, shoulda, coulda is if they had picked up Khalid Sheikh Mohammed when they captured him in Pakistan and took him to New York City and charged him with being, you know, the instigator, mastermind, what have you, of the September 11th attacks, he would likely been long ago convicted and probably serving life at, you know, the Supermax in Florence, Colorado, where his nephew is serving life for plotting the first World Trade Center attack. I know that, you know, there's still some desire in many quarters of America that this remain a death penalty case. And there's a question about whether or not, you know, he could have actually been, you know, suffered the ultimate sentence by now. But they made a decision. They took him to the black sites. They waterboarded him and they brought him to Guantanamo. But in terms of where did these men go? You know, Congress decided mm-hmm. that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed must stay at Guantanamo. It's in the legislation. They said that under no circumstances can money be used from the U.S. taxpayers to do anything, actually, on U.S. soil for any of the detainees who were there. But they specifically mentioned Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. So, you know, I need to clarify that, you know, closing Guantanamo was aspirational for President Bush. He thought we shouldn't have to do this, but did nothing to close it. Mm-hmm. It was intentional. It was an intent of President Obama as a constitutional law expert. It offended him that we would hold people without without trial, without charge, and try to close it. We know that President Trump was an obstacle. He wanted to load it up with bad dudes and didn't. But we don't really know where President Biden is on the spectrum of aspirational versus intentional.
Yeah.
There are 18 or 19 men down there among the 39 prisoners who are cleared for transfer with security assurances, and they haven't done it. There are probably some deals being cooked up in the background, getting countries to take them in for rehab and resettlement, But there's no public face of that aspiration or intention to close the detention center. But closing Guantanamo means, for some people, moving Guantanamo, picking up some of those people, certainly those who are charged and probably those and those who are convicted, and moving them to a detention facility in the United States.
Yeah.
Ideally as convicts, convicted of a crime. At what court? Right now, they're using these military commissions, the post-9/11 court tribunal set up by the military with military panels.
Yeah. You know, Carol, I appreciate the fact that you took us through the intentions of the four presidents who have overseen Guantanamo Bay. Because, you know, to your point, Barack Obama made it a campaign promise and it was his first executive order. But, you know, 7 years later, he was still unsuccessful in closing Guantanamo Bay. He pointed at Congress and basically said politics got in the way and Congress made it harder for the executive branch to close it down. Well, now, under Joe Biden, at least for the next many months, you know, he has a majority in the House and a super slim majority in the Senate, but it's there. But to your point, it's still not clear how much of a priority of closing Guantanamo it is for the Biden administration. I mean, here's one moment, though, in the summer of 2020, where White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said this.
Yes, our goal is to close Guantanamo Bay. I don't have a timeline for you. As you know, there's a process. There are different layers of the process, but that remains our goal, and we are considering all available avenues to responsibly transfer detainees and, of course, close Guantanamo Bay.
Carol, we've got 2 minutes left, and I have two questions for you. First of all, do you think it's going to happen under the Biden administration?
Hard to imagine, Meghna. They haven't done the things that they need to do to, in order for that to happen. Hard to imagine. They would really need to persuade the Congress to lift the restrictions. And as people say, they haven't been willing to expend the political capital to get that done. Closing Guantanamo means moving people to the United States.
So it's easier to ignore it in a sense. But I mean, it's still, if not the moral cost, there's still the financial cost, the $13 million a year per detainee there. I mean, that matters to some people. So, I mean, in the last minute or
not so. Enough. Oh, not enough. Uh-huh. I mean, I've been crunching the numbers and writing those reports for, I don't want to say 20 years because the transparency has come and gone. But, you know, I have to tell you, there are people who are very concerned and very interested in what Guantanamo is, what Guantanamo should be, and whether Guantanamo should or should not be available to future administrations. But that is the minority of Americans. Many, many Americans don't even realize that that detention center is there holding 39 detainees with a staff of 1,500 just at the prison, 1,500 soldiers and contractors, which is why it's so expensive. National Guardsmen every day down in Guantanamo Bay, with a place that's now harder to get to since COVID and easy to ignore.
Americans might want to forget about it, but has the rest of the world forgotten about it?
Not at all. I mean, you can close your eyes and imagine men in orange jumpsuits on their knees in a cage, in shackles. And that's what the world sees and remembers about Guantanamo Bay. And they think it continues. And they're right. They don't look like that anymore. But two of the men in that picture are still there, Meghna.
Well, Carol Rosenberg has been reporting on the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay for 20 years. Now for the New York Times, she's also author of Guantanamo Bay, The Pentagon's Alcatraz of the Caribbean. Carol, thank you so much for your reporting, and thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you, Meghna. Always a pleasure.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.